Welcome to another series of Adore Into the Dark, where the English department, along with other members of Temple Carrick community, explore ideas and subjects on both the junior cycle course and the senior cycle course. This instalment of Adore Into the Dark, we're taking a special look into The Merchant of Venice. I'm joined by Georgia Lee Flynn today and Sean O'Brien, and I'm your host, Catherine Hickey. And in particular, we're going to look at this question of, is Shakespeare anti-Semitic? Big question, guys. Would anyone like to get us going on that?
Yeah. Sure. I'll get the ball rolling. I think it's very important to differentiate between, is it Shakespeare is being anti-Semitic, or is it that he is reflecting anti-Semitism in the community that he lives in?
Mm-hmm.
And for my money, I think it's more the latter. I think he's reflecting on, clearly, if you look through the, the discrimination against Jewish people all throughout European history, mm-hmm. the 1500s, 1600s on through to even the 1900s, it has very clearly been the case that Jewish people are discriminated against. But I personally don't think that Shakespeare himself is anti-Semitic.
Interesting.
Yeah, that'd be my take. But
that'd be your take.
I'd love if someone totally disagrees with me, but what do you reckon?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not going to totally disagree. So, as an English teacher, as a fan of Shakespeare, I'd like to believe that he wasn't anti-Semitic. And I think there's a lot of evidence in The Merchant of Venice to support that view. I was discussing with my own class kind of other things that were going on in Shakespeare's England at the time, and how he brought this play out shortly after one of his rivals, Christopher Marlowe, released The Jew of Malta. And The Jew of Malta was a very one-dimensional look at, Jewish people in the community and how they were viewed by the English and the Elizabethans. But I think The Merchant of Venice has much more ambiguity in it, and there's a lot more doubt over where Shakespeare really falls in the debate. Is he anti-Semitic or was he a Jewish sympathiser?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at it, you also kind of can't help but line it up with some of his other plays. So in Othello, there are disenfranchised black people and women and colonised people who also get a chance to have a voice and defend themselves. And almost always one of their pleas are to get other people to recognise them as fully rounded people and not just, just a black man or just a prostitute or just whatever. And it's something that Shakespeare kind of did throughout his career. So the likes of Othello, those big tragedies were late in his career. Merchant of Venice, I think, is sort of middle of, it's sort of somewhere in around the middle, not quite the very early comedies. But then another one of his earliest plays was Titus Andronicus, which is absolutely mental in terms of a storyline. But there is also a black character who is pilloried and discriminated against. And then at the end, before he gets executed, he again asks for acceptance and people to realize, actually, I'm just the same as you, but it's just that I happen to be black, So I do think that, and this kind of comes to, what's the main famous soliloquy, if you prick us, do we not bleed, and so on.
Yeah.
That Shylock is just another one of those characters who in the society of the time was discriminated against, but not by Shakespeare himself, I think.
I think it's, very easy for us as a postmodernism audience to kind of think, and pose that question, is Shakespeare himself? And I think, like Georgia Lee says, as fans of Shakespeare, we want to say, oh no, he was commenting and he was getting us to look inside ourselves and think about how we treat others. And I know I was at a particular production in the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the cast came on afterwards and I had a discussion about how they approached the play and things like that. And they said, no, we really do want you to sympathise with Shylock. He literally gets spat on. And in the production, the actor, Antonio, literally spits on the actor. And you're supposed to, and they're like sometimes we want to get the audience to be no, don't do that. And then you know what, that kind of engagement. But I think it is, if we're going to argue that question of, was Shakespeare himself anti-Semitic or was he not, or was he commenting on the society? Are there any parts of the play where you kind of go, oh, that might show that Shakespeare does feel this way towards the Jewish community?
I think it's a difficult question because there's so much evidence for both sides that I like to lean into the more positive side and say, no, like, why would he point out all of these similarities between the two communities, the Christians and the Jews? Why would he show us how Shylock ended up the way he is and why he is so bitter and show us how, you know, the supposed hero of the story, Antonio, is actually quite cruel to him. Mm. And, you know, he makes it quite hard for us to actually like Antonio. I know a lot of students in my own class don't really like Antonio. They think he is quite cruel. But at the end of the day, in order to achieve his happy ending for this comedy, Shylock converts to Christianity. Mm. And Antonio changes Shylock, so he's no longer a Jew. And for that reason, all is well, that ends well in The Merchant of Venice. So if he wasn't anti-Semitic, wouldn't it have been maybe more of a statement to end the play with Shylock's faith being respected and existing in that society instead of being erased?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, why does Shakespeare make Shylock? Why is he completely humiliated at the end? Again, is that to evoke sympathy from us, or is it to show that hatred, I suppose, of the Jewish community? And I think also as well that, like, it's really hard when he is making that pact, I suppose, with Antonio and saying, I want a pound of flesh and, you know, on all these kinds of things. It's hard for us to sympathise with Shylock at that point. And he, you know, he is depicted as that stereotypical greedy Jewish, you know, person, man, who's, you know, lending money and, well, if I don't get it back, then this is what I want and I want to try and get my revenge. And I think, I think it's very hard for us to have sympathy at that point.
Like, I just think he's just not a very nice person. Like, you know, like Shylock, I feel sympathy for him because he's in a plight. Like, he is in a plight. He's in Venice where he's despised by the Catholics who, you know, run the show. And he can eke out an existence as a banker effectively, you know, like, but in doing so, he's doing something that's, you know, against religious thought, you know, like, you know, the Catholics weren't allowed to lend with interest. And so that's how he can, like, just about, like, no, I know he has amassed a lot of wealth, but, like, that's the only sort of avenue that he can get into because he's, you know, a lot of the gates are blocked to him for the rest of society. Like, he can't engage in a lot of the rest of the economy. So this is like his one kind of in within that. But yeah, he's not a nice person. And but there's things that happen throughout that you're kind of like, yeah, but, you know, to feel sympathy for him, like, you know, his wife has died, his daughter runs away and, you know, takes his dead wife's ring. Isn't that right?
I mean, she's blind, basically, isn't she?
She trades his most sentimental possession away for a monkey. She trades the turquoise ring that his wife left him for a monkey.
Yeah.
So, like, I can absolutely understand why he's feeling that way.
And then his daughter running away and abandoning her Jewish heritage, marrying a Christian, is that also playing into this idea of, oh, well, the Jewish community is bad, you know, that kind of thing, and, you know, as well, I don't know what that's saying. So we're still on that idea of what clues are there in the text that he is anti-Semitic.
I think also one thing to argue that perhaps bolsters the idea that he's trying to show both sides would be that the Christian characters in the play are not particularly likable either. They're not particularly good people. Yeah. Portia is very complicated.
Yeah.
There is hints that she is perhaps racist in her encounters with the Prince of Morocco. There are moments of really harsh, kind of ruthless judgment of her suitors. And, you know, in that court scene, she didn't have to go as far as she went.
She could have
put that off a lot earlier and said, take your double the ducats here and go.
Yeah,
I've saved my friend. You know, no harm, no foul. Let's just all go home happily now and end the play an act earlier.
Yeah.
But she keeps it going and she's almost vindictive in her punishment of Shylock.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you see it sometimes in like sports analogies, you know, when like teams are beating and like we're going to beat them and then we're going to like really hammer home this idea that they're going to stay beaten through the like by putting another 20 points on them or, you know, that sort of thing. And it's really that, like, the history is written by the victors, you know, like that she gets the happy ending that she's looking for entirely. but she started off with all the advantages in the first place, you know, like she was a trophy that all these people were traveling miles and miles around to come and try to claim her. So she's already from a huge amount of money, a huge amount of privilege, and she manages, you know, without having to do a huge amount other than put on a fake beard to, like, you know, exact revenge on anyone for even trying to upset the status quo, you know, like for like just absolutely hammering home her advantage through like aggression, you know.
Her contempt for Shylock as well is almost unfounded because she's only been married to Bassanio hours.
Yeah.
She doesn't even know Antonio.
Yeah.
And she's willing to destroy this man's life just because he has, you know, caught her husband's friend by the hip, so they say in the play. So, you know, although Portia has her own struggles and her own kind of lack of independence, and she's kind of chained by this casket plot that her father has left for her, she still, as you say, has a lot of privileges, and she doesn't necessarily use them in a positive way in the text.
I think that kind of leads nicely then into, well, what are the clues in the text that show that Shakespeare is merely reflecting society and their views and their ideas and attitudes towards the Jewish community then? So we see that, you know, that reflected in Portia, I suppose. And again, it's that kind of, that he's constantly insulted. Is that what makes us maybe sympathize a little bit more, or is getting us to sympathize a little bit more with Shylock? And is that what Shakespeare is trying to get then? Is that, are we supposed to sympathize? Are we supposed to feel bad? He's constantly niggled at. Is that, is, could that be evidence to show that he isn't anti-Semitic? I don't know.
I think it was a point raised in the previous season by our esteemed leader, Alan Cox, when we were talking about Shakespeare in context, and that a large part of his motivations in his writing have to be to put bums on seats. And so does he not have to write an ending that at the end of the day, we have this dalliance with the Jewish community, but at the end of the day, the Christians have to come out on top, and, you know, the good-looking young people in the story have to come together and, and, you know, get married and all the rest of it. And, like, and it was, he pitched it as a comedy, you know, like, it's not exactly a rib tickler as far as I'm concerned, like, but, you know, if it's supposed to be a comedy, there has to be cross-dressing, and there has to be the couple come together at the end. And if he doesn't deliver on the promise of that genre within his time, then people are going to, you know, kick off. Like, we think of, we always think of Shakespeare now as being this, like, high and mighty writer. But, like, at the time, he was just another Christopher Marlowe. He was just another artist at the time. He didn't have the foresight to know that his stuff is going to be looked at in 400 years by all of us, you know? So, like, he had to deliver on the promise of a comedy. If he said this is going to be a comedy, those certain things have to happen. But so Shylock has to lose. And how best could he lose in to a society who are anti-Semitic? He would convert to Christianity at the end. But he gets his oar in, you know, he gets to put his point across earlier on in the story, and you are left with it's been a while since I've read this play. But I remember if you prick us, do we not bleed? And if you wrong us, do we not want revenge? I remember that much more than because that speaks to the heart of the humanity of the piece. Whereas the bits at the end are vindictive and kind of just like, we have to wrap up all the bits now, you know, because it's a comedy from Elizabethan London.
Yeah, I think, it's interesting because it is, the full title is The Comical History of the Merchant of Venice. And I think it kind of, you point on something interesting there, Sean, like, is it a comedy? I know for us, particularly with doing it with 15-year-olds, a lot of it isn't funny. It's play, wordplay that even goes over our heads, never mind, you know, the third year's heads or whatever. But is it a tragedy or is it a comedy? What do we think on that?
So again, because I like to believe that he's not anti-Semitic, I did wonder to myself whether he pitched it as a comedy to give himself a little bit more wiggle room in what he would get away with. So if you were anti-Semitic and you were watching the If You Prick Us, Do We Not Bleed, you might find it all very funny and, you know, look at how he's been brought down and brought so low.
Right.
And, you know, look at his character destroyed, and maybe you take pleasure in that as an anti-Semite watching the play. But if you have some sympathies towards the Jewish community, putting that play in, or sorry, that monologue in, it would make you really reflect on that and to think about their position and how they're treated in society. So I did wonder, you know, by branding it a comedy, is he actually protecting himself a little bit, given the kind of climate of England at the time, where Catholics were being persecuted, the state was being spied upon, and, you know, religion was a very contentious issue. If it was a tragedy and he put that speech in, then Shylock would be the tragic main character. And I don't know if Elizabethans had enough sympathies to want to come out and pay to see that at the time.
Yeah, the central character being a Jewish character, yeah. Like, it's a tragedy for Shylock, and it's a comedy, a little dalliance for Bassanio and Portia and, you know, for the rest of the Catholics, essentially, that they're, you know, they are relatively untroubled by, like, obviously they're you know, worried about Antonio and everything and all those sort of moments, but they always kind of have their cool, more or less, you know, throughout the interactions. They're able to sort of engage with it more as a game, whereas Shylock is like, my life is being, like, taken away from me piece by piece and for nothing that I've done. And I find it really interesting to, like, regard, like, you know, I kind of want him to have revenge, you know, like, on some level, I'm like, yeah, get that pound of flesh. Like, you know, like, you've been crapped on from a height by everybody in the world around you. Why wouldn't you have a terrible sense of, like, humor or, like, a terrible interaction with everybody around you? Of course you'd hate everyone. Like,
yeah, it's the arrogance of the Christians in the play as well, that they're untouchable. Even, like, as much as I love to see Portia take control and be the one to, you know, quote, save the day, even though, you know, we're not entirely pleased by the ending of the play, she is, like, feels untouchable. Like, she is rich, she is white, she is an heiress. Yeah. She has got really nothing to lose now that she has Bassanio as a husband, because, let's be honest, Bassanio's not really wearing the pants in that relationship. So Portia is basically independent. And while I'm happy about that for her as a character, you know, there's really no loss for any of the Christians in the play. Yeah. Even conveniently, in the last page of the play, Antonio's ships return.
All the ships have shown up, yeah.
We don't even know where Portia got that letter. What connection did she have? And why would they send it to her, an unrelated friend of a friend?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think things would wrap up a little bit too conveniently for the Christians. But then again, is he doing that to kind of juxtapose Shylock's ending and show us just how awful he ends up at the end of the play? And again, it's kind of ambiguous about Shylock. What happens next to him? Because although he says, I am not well, and he leaves the court, he does state multiple times that he would rather die than be a Christian, and that he would rather die than live in poverty, which is now what's ahead of him. So, you know, I would say there's arguments to be made that he does die at the end of the play. You know, we don't know for sure, but he's definitely not going to live a happy life now. He's no daughter. He's no tribe.
Yeah.
He won't be accepted by the Christians, even if he is wearing a cross now instead of a star. And he is utterly alone and living in absolute poverty.
Yeah.
And just Merchant of Venice's, well, particularly in recent years, has kind of become a controversial play. And I think a lot of schools and education institutions have kind of veered away from it. And I'm just kind of, and this might be a controversial question itself, do you think those ideas or attitudes in the play are still reflected in today? And I suppose I'm kind of focused on what's going on over in Israel at the moment with the mass, you know. So do you think it still has a place in our society? Can we still learn from Merchant of Venice?
Absolutely. Like, in not to talk about maths all the time, but it is maths week, so I'm going to have a little plug here. But in maths, the thing that teaches us everything that we learn, everything that we come across in maths, is a problem. So we have to try to come to the solution of the problem every time we walk into class. There's a thing that is unresolved and we have to solve it. And, like, I would rather see texts as being sort of challenges to our current state of mind that make us stop and think, question, critique where we currently stand, and where people in the past stood as well, and that hopefully we become wiser from the dialogue that ensues from it. So I think there's absolutely a need to talk about it. It's just all about how you talk about it. It's not mm-hmm. the thing itself is never the problem. It's the way people talk about it. And the way people talk about these things, if it's not met with dignity and respect first and foremost, then yeah, hate is going to spread. But I personally feel that if we are just left with bland, unchallenging art for both ourselves and for the children that we try to teach, if they remain unchallenged, when are they ever going to grow, you know? So it's not that we have to be constantly like, I don't necessarily want Lolita to be put onto the junior cert course or something like that. Like, that's heavy. Yeah. But like, but we have to challenge where they're at, because if you're 13 and you think you've got it all figured out and you don't have to ever question your, you know, your mindset, then what's the rest of your life going to be like if you're never challenged again? Like, you know, so I'm really glad that we're looking at stuff that makes people stop and think. And yeah, of course, like, you know, it's funny. I was chatting to someone there yesterday about the fact that, you know, people are talking about how it's awful at the moment in Israel and Palestine, that the conflict that's going on. Mm-hmm. And then I was also like, this has also been going on for 2,000 years. Like, you know, it's not going away anytime soon. So us shutting up about it now is not going to help it disappear, you know. And I don't know that it's going to come to any solution anytime soon either, you know. But anyway, sorry.
Thank you so much for that.
I think as well, I was surprised to see it put back onto the junior cycle course last year when I started preparing to teach it. And I wondered, you know, how much do I lean into this question of the anti-Semite or the Jewish sympathizer? And as well, like, given the current global kind of climate, and as you say, the situation in Israel and Palestine, you know, I wondered how it would be received by students, and, you know, what kind of ideas they might have around the topic of Jewishness at the minute. And, you know, I think regardless of opinions on the conflict, which is awful, I think it's really important that we continue to look at texts that show people who are oppressed and that show people from marginalized groups, and that we consider things from other perspectives, because, you know, the more we do that, the more empathy we have and the more we can understand people and their motivations better. And I think it's really important that we don't kind of shy away from those difficult questions with children, because they're actually, I feel like they have a huge capacity for empathy and for understanding people. And, you know, I've found it a very, very interesting text to teach with my classes. And I know the English department won't be happy because we all miss Romeo and Juliet. But some of the discussions that I got this year from Merchant of Venice, you know, they were supposed to be 5-minute chats, ended up being 15-minute chats, because none of us could come to a conclusion. Like, I couldn't come to a conclusion on what the right answer was or how I felt about something. And, you know, the students can raise valid arguments for both sides and it could just keep going forever. And I think that's a really special thing about Shakespearean texts.
Yeah. It's not just that students, and they do have an incredible capacity to be empathetic, but also if you don't catch people when they're younger, it gets harder to become empathetic after a lifetime of having not been empathetic. So, like, it's, you know, the whole thing of can't teach an old dog new tricks kind of thing. Like, if you spent your entire life shutting off other alternative opinions or not having to concern yourself with, you know, oppressed minorities and things like that, why are you suddenly going to start thinking about it when you're 50 and you're already entrenched in the world, in the position you're already in, you know, where you make your money whatever way you do, and so, like, and your family setup is the way it's going to be for the rest of your life, and, you know, all your values have already been baked into the life that you're currently living. Like, you're already on the track of living your life, whereas when you're a teenager, when you're angry and you're unsure and you're thinking about things, you're open to all this stuff. And so we have to create that space now for them to critique and question things, because it'll close, you know, if you don't. That would be my fear, that it will close.
Yeah, I think it's so important that, like, this play gives them the opportunity to see that, you know, just because somebody's portrayed as the villain or the hero doesn't make it so.
Yeah.
And that you should look at it yourself and look closely at their actions and their words, and then make that judgment yourself as to who you think is the hero or who is the villain of the story.
Yeah, like you can have sympathy for someone and still not like them, you know, like that's a really good thing. And I think this play teaches you that really well.
Great. That was some very interesting thoughts shared there. And I really enjoyed that. And I really enjoyed listening to the two of you discuss the question of whether or not Shakespeare was anti-Semitic or was he a Jewish sympathiser. And I'd like to thank Georgia Lee Flynn and Sean O'Brien for joining me today, Catherine Hickey. And I'd also like to thank Oliver O'Neill from Second Year for reciting the monologue, If You Prick Us, Do We Not Bleed? Thank you for joining us for another instalment of A Door Into the Dark.
To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nations, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew's eyes? Hath not a Jew's hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard. But I will better the instruction.